A Ramban in the beginning of Parshas Devarim reflects how carefully the Ramban read Psukim, and in particular parallel Psukim, namely Psukim in different locations which describe the same event. Something which I'm actually recording this year Monday during a fantastic, fantastic Tanakh study week. There are over 10,000 people that attend Shiurim this week in the yeshiva. I don't think there were 10,000 new people, but 10,000 actual Shiurim attended. I think they're probably close to 4,000 or 5,000 people that come. And it's really a convocation of celebrating Torah. It's probably the largest Torah gathering, certainly in the Dati Lumi world, possibly in broader circles, that takes place on an annual basis. Excuse me. And many of the Shiurim are oriented towards what people call a more of a modern study of Tanakh, which obviously is meant to complement the more classic study, Chazal, and many of the Mefarshim, where what people call deconstructionist, where they take the extra letter, the extra word, the extra phrase, dealing with parcels or fractions of Psukim, and in the classic fashion of Chazal, the Yud Gimel Midos, the 13 principles of exegesis, and the methods of the Rishonim, trying to tease out very, very deeply embedded and deeply encoded information and messages. But some of the more global readings of comparing large sections to one another, questioning the way in which Psukim that describe the same event but are embedded in different areas in Tanakh, why did they describe it? Some of these things haven't really been practiced for many years, and there's been a renaissance of some of that practice, and obviously there's a lot of conversation about the role of non-Chazal or non-Mefarshim interpretations of Tanakh, and of course they should complement Chazal, not in any way try to subvert Chazal's authoritative reading of Tanakh. In any event, many Rishonim did practice this. Probably the Abarbanel is best known for his large-scale readings of large swaths of text rather than a few lines or a few words. Ramban less so, but certainly the sense of trying to contrast why a pasuk in one location describes an event one way, and a pasuk in a different location describes the same identical event in a different way. That's something which you have often in the Ramban. And not as often, let's say, in a Rashi or a Rashbam, or more local in their interpretation. So this is one such example, where Moshe Rabbeinu, in the very beginning of Parshas Devarim, describes his decision to appoint and to delegate some of his authority to heads of thousands, heads of hundreds, heads of tens, people that this large bureaucratic system that could help him administer this ever-growing and extremely expanding people and nation. And in his description in Parshas Devarim, two aspects change. Number one, in Parshas Yisro, Moshe had described the challenge of adjudicating and issuing verdicts for various squabbles that had arisen. But it appears as if the larger burden was actually teaching Torah. As a derech yelchuva v'samaisa sher yasun, they were thirsting for spiritual input, for Torah lessons. They were discovering religion. They were discovering this monotheistic, unknowable God. And Moshe appears to delegate for both those tasks, for the very legal task of deciding whether the axe is owned by Reuven or Shimon, and for the more educational task of teaching and educating Torah. Yet in Devarim, Moshe just describes the delegation as surrounding the judicial role. Pasuk Tezayin, Va'atzaveh Perek Aleph, Es Shoftechem Ba'isahi Le'mar, Shema Ben Achechem, you should listen to both sides, to both litigants' concerns, U'shefatetem Tzedek, Ben Ish, Uvein Achiv, Uvein Gero. Sounds like their sole task was adjudication, and the continuing psukim certainly reinforces Lo Sakir Panim Bamishpat, they shouldn't show favoritism while they're issuing their verdicts. So the Ramban claims that ultimately Moshe never relinquished the aspect of Torah education. He did delegate, he did deputize others to be involved in what could be seen as the more technical, necessary, but very technical need to issue verdicts and to resolve litigation and hopefully avoid the type of strife that can erupt in any closely contained society such as the desert encampment. But the actual teaching of Torah, Moshe never delegates. And in this case, Devarim is just really providing a gloss or a revealing read for Parshas Yisro, and makes sense to us that Moshe would want to remain the teacher, the personal teacher of Am Yisrael, because that takes more personality, and that's a manner of conveying that personal touch in a way that perhaps the more practical, technical, or technocratic aspect of issuing verdicts maybe don't require the same personal touch. It made me think a lot about some of the questions that we're facing today in our own educational struggle, and in certainly many communities across the globe, particularly outside of Israel, where there isn't as much government funding for private Jewish or private Jewish religious education. And rightfully so, there are some very, very dedicated people working on cracking this financial crisis and the tuition crisis, and many solutions have been suggested along the lines of hybrid learning or online learning or technologically assisted learning, which would certainly diminish the type of manpower necessary to educate and thereby drive down the costs, which is a great idea. On the other hand, teaching is very important to on both ends. Teaching requires a personal contact, first of all, because Torah is never something which should be objectified or ossified into information in a way that perhaps P'sak is not ossified because it's context specific, but it doesn't. It requires wisdom of the person, but the interaction between the judge and the litigants is less prominent. If anything, the interaction between judges and litigants could be troublesome because it could lead to favoritism and to slanted justice. So in theory, a great trained team of judges sitting in a back room, never meeting the litigants per se, but understanding their situation, hearing their claims, understanding their plight, but without that personal interaction, they may be able to reach cool-headed, objective, balanced verdicts in ways that don't require and maybe are obfuscated and deterred by the personal element. But in teaching, so much of teaching is conveying Torah with your personality, with your love, with your passion, trying to excite people because you're excited, because it's something which you bring your own energy, and if your student senses your energy, then they'll buy in or become enchanted or engaged with the study. So often in yeshiva and gush, there's a question, dilemma that we face as a staff. Should we teach the same old prakim that may be pedagogically great to teach, the first parak of Kiddushin, the first parak and second parak of Bava Kamma, but we've taught them so often that we're becoming a little bit, so to speak, bored or stale. And if, let's say, we taught something which was less pedagogically suitable but excited us more, perhaps the students would feed off of our excitement level. So it's always a question. To be honest, we normally side on the side of pedagogy, especially for youngsters, because some of these more complicated gemaras, which would challenge us as rebbeim and excite us as rebbeim, are probably inaccessible to some beginners. But if we had an older yeshiva, let's say, we probably would err on the side of more complicated. So yes. And of course, not only is personality necessary to convey Torah, but Torah creates a bond and a relationship. And so certainly when we're thinking about how best to create technologically assisted educational frameworks, we shouldn't ignore the personal element within education. And this Ramban reminds us that Moshe was willing to delegate the issuance of P'sak, but not necessarily the education of Torah. Now, the continuation of this Ramban raises a separate issue, which Moshe omits in Parshas Devarim, which is very prominent in Parshas Yisro, and that's the catalyst for this change. The catalyst for the change was Yisro's visit. Yisro witnessing Moshe overwhelmed and suggesting this delegation, and Yisro is completely, completely absent from the description in Parshas Devarim. So the Ramban relates to this in the end. He describes two reasons. I'll say the second reason first, because that's more straightforward, although interesting in its own right. And the first reason depends upon an interesting girsa change. The second reason is because by mentioning Yisro, he would once again remind people of why Yisro came. Yisro didn't just arrive haphazardly. Yisro wasn't wandering in the desert. Yisro was returning Moshe's wife and children. And Moshe had married a foreigner, and that had obviously been the source for Miriam and Aaron's scorn, or at least the derision of Moshe in Parshas Bahaloscha. And Moshe does not want to conjure up that issue which could potentially be contentious in this context. It's not clear where Tzipora is. Remember, Moshe lives 120 years, so he's very advanced in age. It's not clear whether Tzipora is or isn't alive. Her life isn't recorded, or certainly her death isn't recorded in the Torah. But Moshe Rabbeinu is trying to establish credibility and harmony. This is his long soliloquy he's about to deliver, and reminding people, even if they themselves wouldn't look negatively upon his choice, just remembering that Aaron and Miriam had become engaged or embroiled in that controversy can introduce an element of strife in what ultimately becomes the only book in the Torah that has absolutely no strife and absolutely no contention. Obviously, it takes place in a very short time period, but there's no mention of any interactive. Obviously, Moshe describes past events that were stressful, that were contentious. So Moshe omits the mention of Yisro, and he chooses the discretion not to divulge the story of Yisro so as not to create awareness and interest in something that could be very, very that could be very contentious and very stress-inducing. Now, the first reason he doesn't introduce it, according to the Ramban, depends upon a Gersa. The Gersa that we have in our Rambans is he didn't want to discuss it because he wanted to be more humble. Now, that's interesting because it's not really Moshe who's responsible for, who takes the credit, who would win an award for the advice delivery in Parshas Yisro. It's Yisro who senses the need, and it's Yisro who calculates a solution. So why is Moshe omitting this for his own humility? It's not clear, and that's why this is different Girsa. The Torah's Girsa in the Ramban is that he didn't want to suggest that Am Yisrael was dependent upon foreign advice and foreign influence, and at least he wanted to allow them to believe in their minds that this was something internal and in-house and domestic, and especially as he's trying to empower them to face the challenges in Eretz Yisrael. And as they're about to be thrust into an environment where they're not only they're not intended to derive advice from the locals, they're intended to eliminate them because they're pagan savage. So this sense of interaction with foreign cultures and receiving foreign input maybe is less relevant and less suited to the context. So the Torah changes the Girsa from Li Anvesenusa, that Moshe was humble, to Lignusa, and he didn't want to remind the Jews of their own flaws in prior or their own vulnerabilities. I still feel that the Girsa can be justified. The Girsa we have, that Moshe was being humble because he just didn't want to talk about himself, and even though it wasn't his own pride, because he wasn't responsible for that appointment, but it's his father-in-law, and it's his family, and it isn't this. Sefer is not about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is about to retire. Moshe Rabbeinu is about to pass, and he doesn't want to draw any attention to himself. Sometimes we articulate humility just in terms of our own pride and vainglory and egotism. Sometimes we just talk about ourselves and our own world in ways that aren't overtly egotistical and self-aggrandizing, but they shift the conversation to you and yours and your life and your experiences in ways that just aren't appropriate and aren't sensitive. Ask yourself the last time you were at a table and how much of the conversation surrounded you and your life. And it's important tact and ben adam l'chavero, and it's part of humility that you shouldn't be the center of attention even when the statements about you are not necessarily self-aggrandizing or egotistical or prideful or vain. It's just statements about you and your life. Moshe doesn't want in any way redirect this conversation to his father-in-law. It's simply, this is how I decided, and these are the connotations and ramifications for the future and for entering Eretz Canaan. So there are two reasons that Moshe chooses in Parshas Devarim to omit the Yisro component. One is because he doesn't want to introduce extra reason for strife or for just simply salacious or seedy conversations. And second of all, because he doesn't want to draw attention to himself in a way that is probably not directly or overtly egotistical, but is centralizing his own experience rather than decentralizing his experience. Now, of course, these intentions are all appropriate, but isn't Moshe lying? Isn't Moshe, when he's suggesting that he commanded them? Again, the language of the pasuk is "Vatzaveschem ba'isahi." I commanded you to "Shavtechem ba'isahi." I commanded you to appoint all these individuals, all these delegates. Isn't he lying? I mean, the intentions are all proper. Doesn't want to centralize himself. He doesn't want to introduce a basis for negative conversation or sarcastic conversation. But he can't lie. So the Ramban is aware of this, and he concludes with a medrash that says that essentially Moshe had solicited HaKadosh Baruch Hu's input. Even though the simple reading of Yisrael does not have Moshe consulting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ultimately the Sifri, based on a pasuk, acknowledges that Moshe consults with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and receives approval for this suggestion. So Moshe is not really lying when he presents the decision as an executive decision solely authored by himself and, of course, through the inspiration and approval of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's simply omitting certain details that right now could be corrosive or that right now could be inappropriate for his ultimate educational aim. And it's just such a subtle and complex Ramban about, in life, sometimes our decisions about what information to convey and what information to withhold have to be exercised with great discretion. And there could be bits of information that are true but just aren't helpful. And in some cases are deleterious and extremely harmful and injurious to a context and a situation and a person. We have to be careful about what information we do or don't divulge. That's called, of course, discretion and care. On the other hand, it's very dangerous to start altering truth just for human sensitivity. Lying is addictive. It becomes chronic. White lies slips into more white lies, and a person slips down a slippery slope into a world of falsehood and deceit towards others, towards themselves. Eric Hoffer once said that we lie loudest when we lie to ourselves. And Moshe here can't lie, and he has to articulate an idea that resonates with truth, namely that HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded him, which he did after Yisro's initiative, and he withholds the Yisro story for various reasons. So it's just a very wise Ramban. There's nothing outstandingly unique or revelational about this Ramban, but it's a very important Ramban about, first of all, how to read Tanakh carefully and comparing different sections in the Torah describing the same event. And it teaches us about the importance of personal interaction in teaching, maybe less so in issuing verdicts. And it also reminds us about discretion and withholding certain bits of information, but not issuing an actual lie.